COVID-24, Part 1, by Tom Prohl. Peter was shocked awake by the sound of the lab timer going off. He peeled his face off the lab bench, reached for his stale black coffee, and shuffled over to stop the polymerase chain reaction machine. Peter was a tall, lanky young man with a pale complexion that became increasingly yellow and jaundiced with hours under dim fluorescent lights. He transferred the spike protein DNA to the electrophoresis gel and turned it on. Watching the electrical current form bubbles in the gel solution was a moment of zen in an otherwise anxious day. He feared his bosses at the Toronto-based Genentech. The private-public partnership biotech conglomerate had the inertia of a government bureaucracy, but the ruthless expectations of a corporate entity. At any time, grant funding could dry up, which meant deciding between PCR reagents and lunch. After the Great Reset, people's livelihoods became entirely entwined with the quasi-governmental employers who, in one way or another, were all working to fight the virus. Peter had been redeployed from his medical residency program in internal medicine to a vaccine development lab. He had completed an undergraduate degree at the University of Toronto with a minor in immunology before medical school. He knew how to pipette and run a Western blot, but not much more. Genentech was pretty desperate for labor, evidently. It seemed like they needed a new vaccine every few months. COVID-24, much like other clever viruses, harnessed a mechanism of hypermutation, meaning that the antigen structure was always in flux. The virus also devised new ways to enter the cell and bottlenecks, like the spike protein and ACE interaction identified with COVID-19, was not targetable. This presented unique challenges and unique opportunities for biotech companies. They were among the most powerful organizations since the Big Reset. Peter shook his head as thoughts drifted toward conspiracy theories about biotech companies. He often envied the flanneled F-150 driving Canucks who variously blamed China, vaccination, and the Trudeau family for the rapidly changing virus. At least this was the media narrative that he heard on CBC. Their communities were thriving, the Canucks that is, in the reclaimed suburbs. Cookie-cutter McMansions in areas like Newmarket were converted to greenhouses and militia outposts. Premier Gandhi referred to these communities as communes, which suggested a cult-like brainwashing. People felt sorry for these brainwashed communities that had drank the Kool-Aid. Peter, on the other hand, had little time for sympathy. He constantly felt as though he was fighting an uphill battle with the Canucks, as he called them, ignoring all public health directions, and in doing so, spreading the virus like vermin. Was all his work for naught? Peter would hate watch YouTube videos of the Canucks poster child, Daniel Eve. This 20-something-year-old flaxen-haired Brazilian jiu-jitsu gym owner had refused to shut down his business when the province of Ontario had gone into lockdown. He was a phony, just like so many other chuds. He spent his formative years as an outspoken liberal. When his political science degree from York University didn't land him a Senate seat, he threw a tantrum. He opened a jiu-jitsu gym where men could become real men, and he sweated at the soy of his wasted early youth. Peter clenched his teeth with the thoughts of crew cuts, waxing philosophically on Jordan Peterson in the changing room of Alpha BJJ while applying their ringworm cream. Peter's dream of one day becoming a wealthy gastroenterologist, scoping colons for polyps and gold, was squashed. Instead, in the near term anyway, he would spend his days in a MacGyver lab, which was a retrofitted room in Robert's library, which formerly housed a famous collection of Renaissance literature. No one had time for the humanities anymore. These books had been digitized and largely forgotten. Peter wondered how the Italian city-states coped with plague and pestilence, with sometimes half of the populations decimated. One historical fun fact that came to Peter's mind was the etymology of the term quarantine. This was a Latin-derived term describing 2 weeks of isolation at international ports. If only the Canucks had spent more time reading Renaissance history and less time mudding in their trucks, we wouldn't be in this mess, Peter thought to himself. The digital clock on the wall read 7 p.m. It was Peter's time to punch out. He saluted the camera on the wall, only half in jest. It perpetually blinked with a red light. It was very suspicious. He had some colleagues in the antiviral development lab who were fired for romantic relations at work. Apparently, it had been picked up by the cameras. Peter collected his meager possessions, including a cracked BlackBerry smartphone. The fledgling technologies company had been propped up by massive federal investment as part of a track and test grant initiative. The company boasted robust encryption and privacy, but Peter couldn't shake the feeling of being watched as he looked at the blinking notification light on his smartphone. Ahmed, his roommate, had messaged him. "Hey man, I thought we would do something special tonight, so I picked up a shrimp-flavored ramen." Peter replied, "All right, fire up the microwave. I'll be home soon." Peter breathed a sigh of relief when he saw that his Trek bike was still waiting for him. Even though it was a piece of junk, the vultures would grab anything these days. He unlocked his bike chain and slung it around his neck, feeling pretty badass. The brutalist architecture of the Robarts Library loomed oppressive over him. It called to mind Soviet governmental buildings and central planning. The people's fight against the virus could wait until morning. Peter arrived home to his apartment above a dumpling takeout on Spadina. As usual, there was a depressing soup kitchen-like queuing at the takeout window. 6 feet apart, tired eyes squinted above masked faces, illuminated by their smartphones and the neon signs of Mandarin characters. Genentech's stipend of $1,000 Canadian for monthly housing didn't go far. Most places in Chinatown only accepted Bitcoin. Anyway, so he depended on Hassan for money changing. Ahmed was a crypto investor. Peter never fully understood what Ahmed did, and he didn't think Ahmed did either. Opening the door to his two-bedroom apartment, he was welcomed by the smell of ozone and shrimp sauce. "Pistol Peter, you handsome son of a bitch," Ahmed said. "Have a seat." Peter could reliably predict if it was a on day for Ahmed, which meant some sort of stimulant had been imbibed, including Ritalin, Adderall, or street amphetamines. Ahmed's current energy level and enthusiasm were not related to Peter returning home. Ahmed pulled out a chair at the IKEA dining table, made out of particle board that was perpetually damp. Peter started to get suspicious. This was unusual behavior for Hassan, even on his on days. "Ahmed, this is a pretty pathetic attempt at buttering me up. What's the story?" "Now, before you get mad," Ahmed replied, "this will be continued.